Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, best-selling author of the book, The Fitness Mindset and Rewire Your Mindset, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness, and mindset. Today's guest is Professor Jennifer Eitner on how exercise improves memory retention, the impact of sleep deprivation on performance, and sports psychology, process versus outcome. I'm very fortunate and in a very fortunate position where I get to talk to some of the world's leading experts when it comes to their particular field. And in today's episode, I get to explore that with Professor Jennifer Eitner. In today's episode, we talk about mental toughness research and building mental toughness and what the actual research says when it comes to sports psychology. We talk about goal setting and the importance of the correct tracking metric with that, sleep deprivation and its impact on your day-to-day or physical performance. The thing that distinguishes top athletes from regular athletes, that process versus outcome mindset, exercise and its ability to improve memory retention. We go pretty deep on this as the kinesiology and the sports psychology are Professor Eitner's primary focus in terms of her individual research. And I think this is fascinating for anybody that is trying to improve their learning or their memory retention and the impact exercise has on that. We also talk about the research behind mental health benefits of exercise and how to effectively coach kids, yourself, or others by using the current or correct sports psychology. This was a super enjoyable conversation. I learned absolutely loads. And in the research, this is definitely one of the podcasts that I loved researching the most because I did a deep dive into the studies in the lead up to it. So I think that comes across in the episode. Really enjoyable conversation. So without further ado, here is today's podcast with Professor Jennifer Eitner on how exercise improves memory retention, the impact of sleep deprivation on performance, and sports psychology, process versus outcome. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today with my guest, Dr. Jennifer Eitner. Dr. Eitner is a former athlete, a sports psychologist, and a former coach whose research focuses on cognitive benefits of physical activity. She is a fellow of the American College of Sports Medicine and the National Academy of Kinesiology, and received the School of Health and Human Sciences Senior Research Excellence Award and Health and Human Performance Teaching Award, amongst others. She is formerly the president, or was formerly the president, of the North American Society for the Psychology of Sport and Physical Activity and editor of the Journal of Aging and Physical Activity. She's also the author of Bring Your A-Game, a book that teaches mental skills to athletes who want to develop their mental toughness. I'm looking forward to talking all things kinesiology and sports psychology in today's episode. Jennifer, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian. It's a real pleasure.
I'm really looking forward to diving into things deeper just because of the research you've done. I kind of did a complete deep dive on it in the lead up to today's episode, so I'm looking forward to bringing it to the audience. But before we get into any of that, can you talk a little bit about your backstory and what got you into sport? I know you were an athlete first and foremost, so take us on that journey a little bit.
Oh yeah, sure, thanks, that's fun to talk about. Yeah, so growing up, my parents were both very athletic and got all three of us, me and my two siblings, engaged in sport from an early age. I grew up playing basically everything you could play, everything that anybody would want to try. I was happy to try it. In high school, I lettered in three sports. I played soccer, actually had the distinct pleasure of playing with the boys team because we didn't have a girls program at that time. So I got to play soccer with the boys in high school, played fast pitch softball, and also played basketball. And then in college, I continued to play soccer, and that's what I continued to play into adulthood the most. And so that's where I've done a lot of my sports psychology work as well. So I've done some work in coaching education with the United States Soccer Federation, which is what really contributed to me writing the book you mentioned, Bring Your A Game. And then I also wrote a second book that just came out about a year ago called Coaching for the Love of the Game.
Brilliant. Let's unpack your Bring Your A Game first, and then we will dive deeper into other things as we go along. Talk about that book, because you, in there, I know you're teaching people mental skills. One of my favorite quotes from you was, you know, mental training is just as important as physical training when it comes to sport. And like physical training, mental toughness is something that can be taught and learned. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, Bringing Your A Game and mental toughness in particular.
Yeah, sure. So the reason I wrote that book, Brian, was actually because when I was doing those coaching education programs for U.S. soccer, I was meeting a lot of people who were in their 20s and 30s and who were soccer fanatics and had grown up playing soccer and had themselves become coaches. And I was really struck by how many of them told me, wow, I wish I had known some of this sports psychology information when I was a child, or wow, this could have really helped me when I was a collegiate athlete. And so Bring Your A Game was written really for kind of the tweenage slash teenage youth athlete who has aspirations of playing at a higher level, whatever that might mean for them. And so it was really designed to try to make the sports psych knowledge that we have consumable for the young athlete.
With people listening now, because there's variations of kind of skill levels, a lot of people here either go to the gym or they play sport or they're into CrossFit. They've got lots of different things that they're into, but mindset and that element of improving their mental toughness and, you know, just mental discipline in general is something that connects with a lot of people because it translates into lots of areas of our life. When it comes to that area in particular, mental toughness and mental strength, Jennifer, what's something that you know now that you wish you had known back then when you were a college athlete or in your on your particular journey or your own individual journey?
I think that's a great question. You know, I think one of the things that's really interesting to think about is our perception of effort and what it means to give good effort. I've had some conversations with college coaches who have said to me that their college athletes don't really understand what it means when the coach is asking them to give 100% effort. And so the coach is saying, objectively, when I look, it looks to me like they're giving 80% effort. And so what I think, Brian, is for me as a college athlete, I wish that I had sort of realized that I probably had another level to give, that I probably had a higher level of effort that I could have put forth in practice that would have allowed me to reach a higher level of performance as an athlete. And I think, you know, sort of what happens is that we all get into this kind of comfort zone, or we have a tendency to get into this comfort zone where we're having a level of success at some percent effort, but I'm not willing to or haven't recognized that I could push the boundaries and increase my level of effort to 85, 90%, 100% effort in a practice, and then see what the consequences would be of giving that kind of sustained effort during our practice sessions. Does that make sense? Did I say that clearly?
Yeah, it does. I'm curious then, how would you recommend somebody go about tapping into that higher level? Because a lot of us would know that we have another gear that we can potentially go to. For example, you know, I run ultramarathons, I do triathlon, I did bodybuilding for years, I played sport for years, you know, GA, which is our national sport here. You always feel like there's another level you can potentially go to. What are some of the tools or methods to potentially tap into getting to that level that we know we can potentially go to?
Yeah, great. Well, I think one of the things that can be really effective is to use goal setting. So, to really think about, okay, so Brian, I should ask you more about this. When you train, I'm assuming from what you said that a lot of your training might be on your own.
Like yeah.
You're out there running yeah. and training by yourself.
Yeah, at the minute, the last year and a half since I made the transition, or 2 years ago, yeah, it's mostly by myself.
Yeah, so I think sticking with that example, you know, I think what you might do then would be to say, okay, I'm going to map out my week or my 2 weeks or my month of training prior to some event that I care about, some competition that I want to be successful in. And I'm going to look at, okay, what do I think is the right training load for me? And of course, that's really important, Brian, because we're all different. We're all individual. Some people could train at 100%. You know, several days a week or for portions of their practice session, and it wouldn't lead them to burn out or it wouldn't give them an overtraining response. But others would have to be at like a slightly lower effort. So you really have to know yourself. But then once you identify, okay, for me, I think that I could train at this level on this many days with this kind of rest breaks, then I think the key is to use your goal setting to map that out, make a commitment to it, and then also use the tools that you have so that you can monitor the effort you're giving. So I would imagine, Brian, that you might be wearing a Fitbit or a heart rate monitor so that you could monitor the percent of your max that you're training at and make sure that you're hitting your marks. And then on the back end of that, and then be sure to sort of reward yourself for hitting those marks, right? Because goal setting is most effective when it's used in sort of a process where we set goals and then we reward ourselves for meeting those goals. And then we set goals and we adjust goals and we reward ourselves for meeting those goals.
How important is the tracking metric that we're using then? Because I've definitely been a victim of either not tracking effectively enough or efficiently enough based on whatever it is that I'm doing, more so when I was in the bodybuilding realm where I would just go to exhaustion all the time and just completely blow out my central nervous system. How important is the actual tracking metric and how closely tied is that to goal setting in your view?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, you know, the more accurate the metric, the better, obviously, right? So there's a wide range in accuracy if we look at heart rate monitors or distance trackers like accelerometers or pedometers, things of that nature. But I think, you know, I think the key is to figure out what metric makes the most sense for you and then measure it the most accurately. So it might not be heart rate for everybody. It might be more about volume, or it might be sets and reps. And so you have to figure out, and I say this, and I think it's hard, Brian, because when I think of you training, I don't know if you have, you know, an expert who's working with you. He can sort of give you the kind of feedback like somebody in the coach role, but to help you figure out what are those targets that I need to set? What metric should I use? Because like you think about if I switch it to swimming, okay, so the volume of swimming could be in, you know, in laps, and you're going to do those laps. You're going to do them in sets, and you're going to take breaks. And so there's like all kinds of different pieces that you would have to consider. And you want to be really careful and thoughtful as you map that out so that you fine tune it to yourself and also obviously gauge it for when that competition is. Is the competition a month away? Is a competition a week away?
Yeah, that makes so much sense, Jennifer. And that gives me a lovely little segue into one of your studies that I did a deep dive on when it comes to sleep. I think it was an external focus of attention is effective for balance control when sleep deprived, which gives me a nice little segue, as I said. How important is the recovery element then? Because when it comes to, I know sports psychology, and this is your area, again, I'm just kind of a vehicle for trying to ask the right questions that can potentially help the audience. But when it comes to sports psychology, there's so many other areas to look at, like the goal setting element, alongside the tracking metric, which ties into the actual physical training to a degree. How important is the recovery then? And talk about sleep deprivation in particular when it comes to athletes, because I think this is a grossly misunderstood area when it comes to recovery, particularly in Ireland and the UK and a lot of the athletes that I speak with. But can you talk on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question and actually a really big question, right, Brian? So, you know, I think in a nutshell, recovery is critically important. We know that physically, but we also know that mentally. I think in this particular day and age, when we're all dealing with COVID and the additional stresses of what this pandemic have brought, sleep's become even more important, not just for athletes, but for everyday people, right? But sleep is when the body recovers. I mean, there's plenty of evidence that shows us that the brain is recovering and the muscle is recovering, the whole body is recovering when we sleep. The sleep deprivation question, I think, is really fascinating because we also have a lot of evidence that suggests that most people are actually chronically sleep deprived to some extent. Most of us are not taking enough time to allow ourselves to recover, and that's even in the absence of training. So when you add athletic training on top of that, then that sleep becomes even more critical. And if you'll let me get on a bandwagon for just a second.
Please do.
They've got to get their media put away, because what happens is, you know, I if you have your cell phone sitting beside your bed and it makes that noise right as you are about to drift off, that means somebody just texted you or somebody just, you know, liked something that you posted. You tend to look over at it, and now you've delayed your falling to sleep time. And that sleep onset latency is really critical, because it's important that when you get into bed, you fall asleep in a relatively short amount of time so that you can get into those stages of sleep that are so critical for you to actually recover and feel rested when you wake up.
What would be some of the best practices for getting a high quality night's sleep? Obviously, if you mentioned there not having your phone either beside you or turned on airplane mode or not even in the room, lots of different potential techniques that people use that would help them there. But when it comes to best practices for sleep, what would be some of the recommendations you would give?
Yeah, so one of the things is to shut off that media about 30 minutes before you go to bed, right? So it's not just, okay, I'm going to bed now, I'm going to leave the phone outside. That's good. That's a good start. But it's better if you go ahead and shut off all media about 30 minutes before you intend to go to sleep. You know, reading a book in bed is a really nice way to fall asleep. Taking a shower before you go to bed. Having a routine that includes some things that sort of develop the habit of falling asleep and making good sleep habits is really smart. So as an example, sort of going where I was just going, okay, so I shut off the television, I put the phone away. It's about 30 minutes before I hope to actually fall asleep. Now I'm going to take a nice shower, either a warm shower or a cool shower, depending on the time of the year. I'm going to get myself ready for bed. I'm going to crawl in bed and I'm going to read for about 10, 15, 20 minutes. Then I'm going to put the book down. Lights are going to be out. No media on in the house. And that kind of a routine sort of conditions and automatizes the falling to sleep process so that you just make it much more consistent in terms of your ability to like turn out the lights and have it all shut off. I guess the only other thing I'll say is that if you're the kind of person who has things keeping you awake, like it's hard to fall asleep because you've got things on your mind, then one good idea is to have like a journal or some paper near your bed and a pen so that you can write down those things, write down that to-do list. You know, better to do it ahead of time, but if you're trying to fall asleep and those things just won't go away, you can just roll over, write down a couple of things so that you can let those go, let those be released because you've written them down and you know they'll be there waiting for you the next morning.
As somebody who practices that, it's amazing the simplicity of how effective it is at just getting, if your brain is in overdrive, you know, particularly like type A personalities that are just go, 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 thinking all the time, it just gets it all out, to-do list onto a page, and before you know it, you've fallen asleep. So I can definitely speak to that firsthand. When it comes to recovery, just to stay on that topic slightly, even though we might transition out, one of the things I've changed my mind about in recent years, Jennifer, and I think it's just coming down to reading more studies, reading more books, consuming more information. I always had a misconception of recovery as a, well, it's a nutrition thing, but I also just didn't think about the sleep element. And now I have them kind of hand in hand when it comes to recovery. What's your thought process on recovery when it comes to sleep and nutrition, particularly for athletes and sports nutrition? Do you think that they're equally important, or does one take priority for you when it comes to overall recovery for athletes?
Yeah, I don't want to speak beyond my expertise, Brian. So I really think I hesitate to say one's more important than the other. I mean, I think, you know, you bring up a really good point, which is we went quickly to sleep, which is vitally important. And I think a challenge because there is great evidence that shows that people are chronically sleep deprived. Like that's a pervasive problem. That being said, I think you just bring up a good point, which is that in terms of recovery, you have to make sure that you're replacing the calories that you've burned. You want to replace them with high quality calories. And then I think it's important to also mention, obviously, hydration, right? So hydrating, making sure you've got the right kind of nutritional input prior to your training sessions, and then making sure that you've got a good plan for recovery in terms of replacing those burned calories and that you know, replacing the hydration as well. There's some neat work actually that's being done by Dr. Will Adams. He's now the Associate Director for Sports Medicine at the United States Olympic Training Center, where he's doing a lot of work looking at dehydration and finding out that in addition to people tending to be chronically sleep deprived, a lot of people are actually chronically dehydrated as well. So I think, you know, there's recovery, which is after the fact, but there's also sort of just baseline, right? Like in a baseline sense, people in general would benefit from paying attention to the types of calories that they're taking into their body, making sure that they're high quality caloric intake, making sure that they're staying hydrated, and then also paying attention to their sleep habits.
I'm curious, Jennifer, based on, you know, you mentioned the hydration studies there, this may be studies you're doing yourself, or it may be ones that you've came across yourself, but is there any particular studies or areas that are currently of high interest to you that are really piquing your curiosity at the minute?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think some of these questions that are looking at combined factors are really interesting. So a lot of the work that I do is focused on how both single sessions of exercise and regular physical activity participation can benefit our cognitive performance, our ability to do daily mental types of tasks. And, you know, we find pretty clear evidence that a single session of exercise, for instance, can allow you to perform better cognitively, can allow you to do better on memory tasks in the short term and also in the long term, which I think is interesting. So if I asked somebody to do 20 minutes of moderate intensity exercise right now and then gave them something to remember after they finished that task, if I tested their memory on that topic 24 hours later, it would be better than if they hadn't exercised. So there's like short-term benefits, and there's also kind of more durable benefits from a single session of exercise. So what I think is interesting, Brian, to get to your question, is those studies now that are trying to kind of combine the two. So if you know that somebody is dealing with sleep deprivation, maybe they have a hard time, you know, they've got some sleep challenges, or they have a job that makes it hard for them to get enough sleep. Well, then how do you use a single session of exercise in the face of that challenge to benefit the person? And, you know, what we're finding out is that you might have to make the exercise not as challenging to get the same benefit, which I think kind of makes sense. So if somebody's in a compromised position because they're sleep deprived, well, then maybe moderate intensity exercise isn't ideal to improve their memory. Maybe because they're somewhat compromised, they need lower intensity exercise to achieve those same benefits. And so, I mean, I'm sort of getting at some of what I'm really interested in understanding more about is sort of dose response questions, but then dose response in unique scenarios, right? So if somebody's very well rested, maybe I actually could use a higher bout of exercise to get those same benefits. And that's where I think it gets really, really quite intriguing.
When you speak on dose response, you're talking about the intensity levels, just for everybody that's listening.
Yeah, intensity and duration.
That's so interesting. Jennifer, why is, from what you've seen, the case of, you know, the memory retention, is it down to the BDNF, the brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or is it down to something completely different? That, because that's such an interesting element, because I find one of my daily habits has been for the last several years, since I went down a rabbit hole of exploring this, was always listening to audiobooks off the back of my workout sessions, because the retention for me has always been higher. Why is that? What's the reason for that happening?
Yeah, great question. It's like the million-dollar question, right, Brian? We don't know yet. I think, you know, you mentioned brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF. That is definitely a likely candidate to explain why we're getting these benefits. You know, for the listeners, BDNF is a neurotrophic factor. Its job is to, I sort of think of it as like Miracle-Gro for the brain. So when you add BDNF, you can have better neurogenesis, development of new neurons, and you also have, which I think is important, sort of some pruning of unnecessary dendrites and paths. So it's maybe Miracle-Gro. It's not just Miracle-Gro. It's like Miracle-Gro and also somebody with some hedge clippers. So you're pruning the synapses in the brain to make them ideal for remembering what it is that you're trying to remember. But the BDNF literature is a little bit challenging, Brian, because obviously we can't measure BDNF in the brain. I shouldn't say obviously. We don't have the techniques right now to measure BDNF directly in the brain. So we're making inferences from samples that we're getting peripherally, from blood samples, from blood draws. The other thing that I just wanted to mention is that, you know, I think a lot of times as scientists, we try to be reductionists, right? So we try to figure out, okay, what is it that explains why a single session of exercise improves memory? And we look and we reduce and we try to say, is it BDNF? Is it VEGF1? What exactly is it? But I think sometimes it would help us to pull back and sort of take more of a like a helicopter view and say, it's probably a lot of different mechanisms going on simultaneously. So it's probably not only BDNF, it's probably BDNF and a host of other things that are happening in the body when the body is challenged physiologically as it is in an exercise session.
When it comes to exercise and memory retention, then, is there like a point of diminishing returns? So obviously, based on the dose response of, based on if you're sleep deprived, as you said, you're not going to be able to go as high intensity. But could you potentially, and I'm kind of asking more personally, if you did multiple sessions through the day, would that or has that been shown to potentially improve memory retention? Or is there a point of diminishing returns when it doesn't happen any longer?
I love that question, Brian, because it makes me think I need to get into the lab and do some more work. that's a really cool question, you know, because a lot of the work that we've been doing in my lab has been trying to understand how the timing of the exercise session might impact the memory retention or the memory benefits. And I feel reasonably confident in saying that you're going to get the best benefit if you exercise prior to exposing somebody to what it is that you want them to remember. So if I was talking to a student, I would say, if you're going to study for a test, exercise prior to that study period. If you exercise after you study, you're still going to likely get some benefits. They just won't be as big. But now to your question, Brian, we have done one study where we had people exercise, study, if you will, and then exercise again. And that actually gave us the biggest benefits, more so than exercise, than if they only exercised before. But we haven't gone as far as what you just sort of said, Brian, which is, okay, now you've exercised, you've studied whatever you're going to study, and you've got this consolidation period. Maybe your exam's tomorrow, right? So you exercise, you studied in the morning, you've got this whole day ahead of you and your exam's the next morning, okay? Would it help to have repeated exercise bouts during that consolidation period? And I haven't seen any research that's actually done that specific design. Would it help if you exercised prior to the test the next morning? I think it would, right? We've got a little bit of evidence that suggests that if you exercised prior, that would likely help you to recall that material. But this question of sort of repeated bouts across the day, as far as I know, nobody's looked at that yet. And that's an intriguing question to try to answer.
Yeah, I'd love to know. It's one that if you were trying to recall or studying for something in particular, is there a way to jigsaw effectively your puzzle piece of exercise in on top of it?
Yeah, but then you did ask about diminishing returns, and I think that's likely, right? So if you exercise so much that fatigue now became a factor, then that might not be the best choice. We do have some evidence, and this I think is really intriguing. If we ask people to exercise at a maximal level, like we have them actually do a maximal exercise test on the treadmill, what we found out is that memory right after that maximal test is not benefited. Let me say this the right way. If they did moderate intensity exercise versus maximal intensity exercise, and I measure their ability to remember something right after the exercise, moderate intensity is better. But if I look at memory 24 hours later, maximal exercise is better. So the idea that we think might matter is that it might tie into BDNF. Perhaps when you do that maximal exercise, you're getting the biggest impact on BDNF that you could get. And because that can sort of, those high levels of BDNF are going to stay with you during the consolidation period, perhaps that's why you get the better recall 24 hours later after maximal intensity exercise. So it's, you know, we still have a lot to learn, Brian, and there's been a lot of research done in this area, but there's still some of these questions about dose response that really need to be untangled.
It's such a fascinating topic. Like, that's one I could go down the rabbit hole all day speaking about or reading about. I want to pivot out, Jennifer, into coaching for the love of the game. Talk to us about the book. Talk to us who it was for and your reason for writing it.
Yeah, thank you so much. So I told you a little bit about the first book that I wrote, which was really targeted towards youth athletes. But, you know, one of the things that I'm really invested in is in general trying to improve the youth sport experience. As a kinesiologist and as somebody who's focused on the mental health benefits of exercise, I see so much value in regular physical activity. And I personally want everybody in the world to be physically active, to meet the guidelines, to meet the recommendations, because I know that there are physical and mental health benefits. Well, one of the ways that we get people to love being physically active is through our opportunity to interact with children who are engaged in youth sport. And so Coaching for the Love of the Game is a book that I wrote for coaches. And the whole purpose is really just to remind coaches, hey, why'd you get into this in the first place? Most people who are coaching youth sports got into it because they love kids, they love sport, they want to give back to the game, and they want to, you know, engender a passion for sport in these kids that they have the opportunity to work with. And so Coaching for the Love of the Game was written just to sort of satisfy exactly what the title says, which is to remind coaches, hey, you're doing this because you want the kid you're coaching to fall in love with the sport. So how do you coach in a way that tries to make sure that happens?
As someone that's written a few books myself, one of the things that I have to ask everybody that's an author is, what's one of the biggest things that gets quoted back to you about that book in particular, Jennifer?
Oh, that's a great question. And I'll tell you, the timing of that book coming out couldn't have been worse. So it came out in March of 2020, which, as you all may remember, was the start of the COVID pandemic. So here I wrote this sport for youth sport coaches, this book for youth sport coaches, and it came out right as youth sport was shut down everywhere. But I think, you know, one of the biggest pieces of feedback that I've gotten from the people who have had a chance to try to implement what I'm teaching with this book is this critical need to focus on process as opposed to outcome. So, you know, we sort of started with goal setting in our conversation today, Brian, and goal setting is so important. But when we goal set as coaches or athletes, it's so important to focus on the process that's going to get us to the outcomes we care about, not to focus on the outcomes themselves. So when I hear from coaches who have picked up Coaching for the Love of the Game, that's one of the biggest things that they'll talk about, is sort of the importance of being reminded of that.
What would an example of process versus outcome be? And I ask this question coming from a place of somebody who had a lot of definite misconceptions around thinking in general, where I was always outcome based on every goal I set. I actually think it was one of the reasons why I was a good athlete but never a great athlete in my younger days, was because I was always outcome driven and didn't focus on the process. But then when I, you know, consume information about people like, you know, LeBron James or Cristiano Ronaldo or Lionel Messi or people who are the pinnacle of their sport, it's all about process for them. They've got their targets, they've got their goals, but they always speak about the process, the basics. Explain and expand what process versus outcome would look like as an example, just as somebody that I'm been out this other side, but there's a lot of people listening who will connect with that because I definitely needed to hear it several years ago. Explore process versus outcome for us.
Yeah, sure. Let me try to give just a really simple example. As a soccer coach, a lot of times we'll say to the kids, hey, everybody grab a ball, pick up the ball, and let's see you juggle with your feet, right? So juggle with your feet. They go off, they do it. Say, okay, come back in. If I'm outcome oriented, what I'll say is, okay, who got the most, right? And so I say, who got the most? And one little kid, you know, they start figuring out, one little kid goes, hey, coach, I got 8 tries. And if I'm outcome oriented, I go, that's great. Way to go, Johnny. You're the best, right? Well, it's such a clear example because I have one child now who feels great about what he's accomplished. I have 10 or 11 other kids who are thinking, okay, I wasn't the best, right? And so the coach doesn't care. So all you have to do is sort of switch your mindset when they come in. And so instead of saying who got the best, I simply say who improved from last week. When I say who improved from last week, I could get all 11 kids to raise their hand. All 11 kids could have done better than last week. And what I think is so, you know, ironic about that is the coaches who focus on outcome, they're only helping one kid to have a sense of accomplishment. The coaches who focus on effort and improvement and process can have all children feel a sense of accomplishment. If all children feel a sense of accomplishment, guess how many of the kids are going to try harder the next time I ask them to juggle? They're all going to try hard. And so it's this positive cycle where by focusing on process and effort and allowing every child to feel successful if they improved, every child can have a sense of accomplishment and therefore can be motivated to give it their all the next time they have an opportunity.
And the funny thing about that for people listening is it's the exact same method and model as an adult. Like when I'm working with people on weight loss goals or fat loss goals or building muscle or toning up in terms of coaching, that's the element that I focus on. It's always on the process. You know, how was your meals today? How was your workout today? You keep the end in mind, but you focus on your day to day because that's what adds up. And I think that transcends into sport. It transcends into goals that you set yourself in your personal life. It transcends into weight loss. There's so many different areas that process over outcome is so important because it's what you do day to day that determines your results. And I think that's so important from kids. You know, I've got my 6-year-old at home who's learning camogie at the minute. So Ginny, camogie is like a, I don't know how I'd explain it, like it's like a cross effectively, and always focusing on that process of if she follows the correct technique and she hits the ball, brilliant. If she follows the correct technique and doesn't, I always be like, well, the technique was right. I'm like, you'll get the ball next time, as opposed to just swinging wildly and hitting it, where that's the outcome driven. So it's funny you said that. It just brought it right back to what I was doing earlier this morning.
Yeah, well, that's such a beautiful example. And to hear you talk about that with your 6-year-old really warms my heart, because that's exactly right. So if the technique is right and we reward the technique, the outcome will eventually follow. But if we just reward outcome, you can get outcome from terrible technique. So,
that's the problem. You know, that's the problem.
Yeah, that is the problem, right? You're not going to help the child or the adult that you're working with to improve if you're only focused on outcome, because that doesn't tell you anything about how you achieve the outcome.
Yeah, I think it's so valuable to take that on board, regardless of where your starting point is now for those listening to this conversation. With the book then, Coaching for the Love of the Game, another question that I love asking people who have written books is, what was your favorite section to write? And I ask that question because it's very rarely the part that is the most quoted back from my experience anytime I've asked that question. But from your experience since you've released it, I know it wasn't the ideal time in terms of March 2020, but what was your favorite section to write in the lead up to the release?
Yeah, I really liked writing the section. I wrote a section about asking the question of if there's a difference between coaching boys and coaching girls. And I guess I liked writing it the most because I feel like there is a perception out there that there are a lot of real differences between working with girls and working with boys. And what I try to do in that chapter is kind of to tear that down by really making the case that there's much more in common between young girls and young boys than there is different. And that really it's the individual differences in kids that sort of carry the day. So you could have a little girl who is wildly competitive and will knock over every other child on the field to get to that ball or to get to the end line or whatever it might be. And you could have a little boy who's much more passive and less competitive. So the range, you know, there's incredible overlap and commonality between girls and boys. And also, it's the individual differences that really good coach tune into and figure out how to use to advantage to help every individual child reach his or her own potential.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's definitely going to be the section I go back into as I continue down my journey with my daughter. You mentioned there as well about mental health benefits of exercise. So I definitely want to pivot back to that, just because I know the books you're writing, Coaching for the Love of the Game, Bringing Your A Game, like you're getting people at a young age. And I think from my personal, again, this is completely my own bias, that one of the reasons that sport can be so effective is that it gives you a vehicle for fitness that you may not find otherwise. It's not going to be sport for everybody. That's why some people in their 20s, 30s take up the gym, they take up running, they'll do something that might be outside of what would be traditional sport. But the mental health benefits, as you said, is something that everyone should be aware of. Talk a little bit about the mental health benefits of exercise, just because people listening to this podcast will know, but there's also a chunk of people who will do it for the outcome. They want to look a certain way, they want to improve their performance for their sport, or they want to lose weight, or they want to build muscle, or they want to look a certain way, which is outcome driven versus process driven, nearly to a degree that we talked about earlier. But talk about the mental health benefits of exercise.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great question. And I think, you know, one of the things that I would probably ask of people who are exercising to lose weight or who are exercising for their sport and to be competitive is to take a second at the end of the exercise session to sort of reflect on how they feel. Because most people who have adopted regular exercise will have a really nice feel-good phenomenon following their exercise bouts. Now, sometimes during the exercise, it's hard work. You're pushing yourself or you're new to exercise, and so it's aversive and it's not that enjoyable. But what's really important to do is once you finish, think about how you feel then, because we have so much evidence, Brian, that regular exercise reduces depression, reduces stress, reduces anxiety, whether we're talking in those cases about clinical forms of depression and anxiety or we're talking just about, you know, sort of normal day-to-day fluctuations in mood. Exercise improves positive mood, feelings of relaxation, sometimes feelings of vigor, you know, sort of depending on the individual and the nature of the exercise bout. Also, my area of research which I am so committed to, which is demonstrating that exercise improves cognitive performance. And importantly, Brian, I'll just say, I believe that we have clear evidence that it improves cognitive performance across the lifespan. So for children who are in school, regular exercise can help them to be more successful in the classroom. For young adults who are maybe in college or working in a job, they're employed and they have a lot of cognitive demands, exercise and being regularly active can help them to have better performance. For people who are more towards the older end of their lifespan, we know that people suffer age-related cognitive declines and some people suffer clinical cognitive decline. Well, exercise can be protective against that. So we have just a huge body of evidence that shows that exercise is so beneficial in all of these mental health areas.
And something we won't go into today, but I highly recommend checking out for those who are interested, is your studies on Alzheimer's. You've had a lot of work on Alzheimer's disease. And I think for those who that is close to their heart, either for personal reasons or familial reasons, I highly recommend, I'll link them in the show notes for today's episode as well for people to check in on. But with that in mind, when it comes to mental health and the benefits of exercise, is there a type of exercise that tends to be more supportive than others in terms of high intensity, in terms of low moderate exercise, or is it a combination of both?
You know, let me, Brian, I hate to do this, but I'm going to give you kind of a cop-out answer. My cop-out answer is do the kind of exercise that you enjoy and that you'll stick with. So if it's CrossFit for you and you like high intensity interval training and you enjoy that and you, after you're done, you have that feel-good feeling, well, keep doing that by all means. But if it's walking for 30 minutes, take your dog for a walk or to go walk with your family, that can be enough. So the evidence that we have basically tells us that low to moderate intensity exercise is sufficient. But for people who are athletes, then they're going to want vigorous intensity exercise because that's what's going to make them feel good because they're already trained and fit. We also know that you could accumulate bouts of exercise throughout the day. So if you get in a, you know, maybe you, when you go to work, I work at a university on a campus. So maybe I could park further away from my building so that every morning I make sure that I get a 10-minute walk into my office and a 10-minute walk back. Then I've accumulated 20 minutes without even really doing anything other than just sort of transporting myself to and from my place of employment. And that can be effective if you can't find time to squeeze in that 30-minute bout of exercise that you would prefer to do.
I think that's great advice and is so in alignment for what we talk about on this podcast of finding what you enjoy. Like the best exercise at the end of the day is going to be the one that you can stick to over the long term. Of course, one that's in alignment with your goal is always going to be the most supportive, but what you can do consistently day to day is always going to be the key. So if you enjoy walking, walk more. If you enjoy CrossFit, do CrossFit. If you enjoy running, run, because they're the things that are going to help with your mental health in particular. So I absolutely love that answer. I think that works really, really well here, Jennifer. And as somebody that is a big proponent of adding up those extra steps by, you know, exercise that doesn't feel like exercise. For example, I'm recording our podcast from a standing desk, which means that I'm standing up for large portions of the day because I could be interviewing for 6-7 hours on a given day, and at least you're on your feet, so you're not sitting down for the entire day. So those little hacks can be really, really helpful for people. And I think, as you said there, parking further away is just one low-hanging fruit that people can use that can help them get moving more throughout the day. Jennifer, I've loved this conversation. There's just so much here. Your research, as I said, I did a deep dive into, and particularly around the retention exercise and memory retention. I think that area is absolutely fascinating. And as somebody that kind of geeks out on that stuff, I want to thank you for putting it out there and coming on and spreading your message. And for everybody that's listening, where's the best place for them to connect with you potentially, or pick up the books, or any links, or anywhere you want to send them now? Please give those links.
So if anyone's interested in my books, they're available through Amazon. And Bring Your A Game is actually available in an Audible version as well. And if people are interested in my research, they can learn more about that if they go actually to our homepage for our Alzheimer's study, which is PAAD2.uncg.edu. And Brian, let me just also thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to speak to your listeners, and what really fun conversation today. I appreciate all the homework you put in the foreground so that we'd be ready to talk about these topics.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. I've been dying to do this conversation since we got it set up. And for everybody listening, I will link everything that Jennifer said in the show notes on briankeenfitness.com and in the description for today's episode. So wherever you're listening, on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on Stitcher, you can click straight on through to the book links and click straight on through to the studies. Jennifer, thank you so much again for all you do. Thank you so much again for coming on. I know how busy your schedule is, so I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian. It's my pleasure for sure. Take care.
There you have it, Professor Jennifer Eitner on how exercise improves memory retention, the impact of sleep deprivation on performance, and sports psychology, process versus outcome. As I mentioned at the top of the podcast, this was definitely one of my most enjoyable researches for a podcast. Love the topics that we covered. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you did, let me know. You won't get Jennifer on social media. She will be in the links in the description for her research. She's not on social media. She's a little bit on Twitter, but that's the height of it. But you can let me know. Hit me up on Instagram, Brian_Keen_fitness. Let me know what you thought. Again, we went quite heavy on the science, heavy on the research. This is something that I completely geek out on because I love it. So I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed recording it. That's everything from this week's episode. Catch you all next Monday.